Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin on this Thanksgiving as families and friends gather around the table for the traditional holiday feast and look into the uncomfortable subject of hunger in America and speak with Zuani Villarreal, the Director of Communications for Feeding America, the nation's largest hunger relief organization. As many Americans volunteer today to feed turkey dinners to the homeless, and former President Obama works at a food bank in Chicago, we'll address the need to feed 41 million Americans who are struggling with hunger, including nearly 13 million children. And while 58% of food insecure households participate in government programs like SNAP, the National School Lunch Program, and WIC, there are relentless efforts on the part of Republicans to cut back on these programs in spite of the fact that 1 in 8 American households cannot provide enough food for their members. And since over 45% of households in the United States are headed by women who are the sole breadwinners, households with children led by single mothers experience the highest rates of food insecurity. In addition, about a quarter of food insecure households report incomes that make them ineligible for any form of federal food assistance. Meanwhile, every day Americans waste 72 billion pounds of food, much of which ends up in landfills. Then on this Thanksgiving, we will explore the notion of what we can be thankful for and speak with Stephen Schwartz, the editor of the daily web publication, theschwartzreport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future as we look for positive signs on the horizon in this dark period of hatred and division, deliberately brought about by a minority government which is aggressively destroying programs and institutions the majority of Americans need and support. The author of The 8 Laws of Change, Stephen Schwartz, outlines the megatrends shaping the world under threat by climate change, which Trump and his backers are refusing to acknowledge, let alone deal with. And again, in terms of the malignant and malevolent misrule by a tyranny of the minority, we explore the underlying anxiety which animates Trump's base that he riles up with racist dog whistles as he shamelessly scapegoats minorities. And that is the future trend that simply being born white will no longer confer privilege. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us on this Thanksgiving is Zuani Villarreal, who is the Director of Communications for Feeding America, the nation's largest hunger relief organization. Welcome to Background Briefing, Zuani Villarreal.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm happy to be here on behalf of Feeding America.
Well, thank you for joining us. And on this day when people are feasting, families get together, a lot of charities like yours do feed the homeless and the hungry. And I think it's a shocking statistic, but nevertheless an important to tell our audience about the level of hunger in this country. 41 million people in this country face hunger. That's 12.3% of American households, meaning 1 in 8 households in the United States have difficulty providing enough food for their members. So how does this look on Thanksgiving? Much focus, of course, in the news. You see people serving the homeless, etc. But this is not a problem that we should be focusing on just one day a year, surely. This is a 365 days a year that people are hungry.
Correct. As you mentioned, it's about 40 million people in the United States that face hunger and that struggle on a daily basis to put food on the table. And so that's about more than 12 million children, 1 in 8 people that they live in every county in the United States. We do a study every year called Map the Meal Gap, where we look at USDA data, Census Bureau data, labor statistics, and all of that to drill down to the local level to find out what the food insecurity rate, which is, you know, the being at risk of hunger, what that looks like at the local level by county, by state, and by even by congressional district. And through that study, we know that food insecurity exists in every county in the United States, from the most wealthiest county that you can think of in, which I think is Loudoun County in Virginia, to the county with the highest food insecurity rate. In every county, you will find somebody, a family, an individual, a senior that is struggling. And it could be a short-term crisis where it's a job loss or cut in hours and they're really struggling to get by in the immediate aftermath of that. It could be something just even now as we're thinking about. It's the holidays. Kids are out of school during the Thanksgiving week. The holiday break in December is coming up. Kids will be out of school then. So those are meals that families need to provide for that normally they would get that lunch at school. And then as well in the winter, weather, temperatures are dropping. So, you know, gas bills may be going up and that eats into the budget of a family that really has no wiggle room. So it could be anything from that kind of daily struggle to something even on the scale of a disaster. You know, we've had the fires and we've had the hurricanes that hit earlier this year. Families that pretty much lost everything, and it takes time to get back on their feet. So while they're working to either find another job or to rebuild their home, we don't want families at Feeding America, we don't want families to struggle to put food on the table. And that's why we do what we do on a daily basis with those 200 food banks that are part of our network.
So that's 200 food banks and 60,000 food pantries that
Correct.
Your organization provides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those 200 food banks provide food and have partners that serve every county. All 50 states, D.C. and Puerto Rico. And those 60,000 partner agencies they could be church pantries or community centers, after-school meal programs, senior meal programs, anybody that's providing meals, food, whether it's a meal or a food box to families and individuals in need, will more than likely want to partner with the food bank to get that food out through that network.
So what's the situation vis-a-vis the government's support? I take it you get most of your support from individuals and corporations who donate to you. Is that right?
Correct. At the national level, we work with all businesses, farmers, and manufacturers, and everybody in the food lifeline, from the field to the table. So farmers and growers, manufacturers and processors, retailers and wholesalers, even restaurants and caterers and hotels that are preparing food. So we're partnering with everybody along that spectrum to rescue food and deliver that through that network of food banks and partner agencies. Now, we talked about Thanksgiving today. Thanksgiving is such a food-centered holiday. You know, no matter your background, no matter where you live, here in the U.S., Thanksgiving, it's the turkey on the table and the stuffing and the sides, and it's an opportunity to come together. And even though maybe your family's in a tough situation and you're struggling, the food banks and Feeding America, we want to do everything we can to make sure that that families have that opportunity to sit down at the table and have a delicious and nutritious meal together, to give them a little bit of hope, a little bit of happiness in maybe this difficult time.
And again, I'm speaking with Zawani Villarreal, who is the Director of Communications for Feeding America, the nation's largest hunger relief organization. And on this Thanksgiving, where people are participating in Thanksgiving meals, we're just talking about the less fortunate among us, the 41 million people who struggle with hunger in the United States, including 12 million children. And there is, of course, 58% of food insecure households participate in at least one of the major federal food assistance programs, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, formerly mm-hmm. known as food stamps, the National School Lunch Program, and the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, called WIC. So let's talk about those programs. which you are supplementing, but the fact that your organization has to exist in the first place indicates that the government is not doing all that it could or should. Is that a fair statement?
Well, it's definitely, I think the issue is such a big issue that, when you think about 40 million people in the country that struggle to put food on the table, it's going to take a lot of work, not just from the public sector and USDA and the federal government, but it's also going to take the help of everybody along that, corporations and manufacturers and businesses, to foundations and policymakers and individuals that can all come together and help us tackle this problem of hunger. And the reality is, and something that we all know, is that it is a solvable problem because in the United States, we produce enough food. A lot of the food goes to waste and ends up in landfills. It's about 72 billion pounds of food that ends up in a landfill every year. And that's not food. We're not talking table scraps. We're talking about produce that was left in the field and not harvested, to product that was manufactured and packaged, but maybe there was a slight error in the formula or an error in the packaging that made it unsellable. So that's 72 billion pounds of food, and if we can work with everybody from the government to manufacturers and distributors to truckers to wholesalers to try to reduce that amount of food, to rescue that food and distribute it out through our network, then we can solve hunger.
And added to that, you go to restaurants and you see first of all, I think compared to the rest of the world, we serve some huge proportions in this country. There's no two ways about it. But then more often than not, you see at restaurants people sort of leaving tables with tons of food left. And, of course, by law, none of that food can be recycled. Is there any way to sort of reduce the wastage there, on top of the 72 billion pounds of food that goes into landfill?
Right. Unfortunately, food that's been served, as you mentioned, we can't rescue that food. But chefs and restaurants and caterers can be more mindful and measured in what they serve and what they waste as well. I know that there's a lot of movement and talk around among the chef community to really reduce waste and really use everything that is available to you so that none of it ends up in the landfill. Now, interesting innovations that we're working on at the national level with Feeding America is that we and our food banks are doing this incredible work of innovating, trying to use that food that would be wasted in different and innovative ways that still provides healthy food for people in need. So I'll give you a couple of examples. So one is our food bank in Philadelphia, Philabundance, is now partnering with dairy farmers to reuse or to rescue the food, the milk and whey that is not packaged, that is not used or sellable, but they can use that product to make cheese and yogurt. So the food bank is partnering with those dairy farmers to use that product and manufacture it or process it to now get cheese and yogurt that they can distribute out to people in need. And cheese and yogurt has a longer shelf life than milk. And it's nutritious, it has vitamins and minerals that people need. So it's a win-win there, and we're reducing the waste. Another example is our food bank in Portland, Oregon, is partnered with Pacific Foods, a soup company based out of Oregon, and they partner with them a year. They'll manufacture soup, but it's soup that's made directly for the food bank to donate. So it's not soup that was made to be sold and for whatever reason was not. It is made intentionally and purposefully as a donation to the food bank. And so the food bank partners with them to source product or harvest excess produce that they can use and make into a soup that the food bank can then in turn distribute.
So are there foods that are nutritional but not popular? Because it seems that the most popular food is often the least nutritional, like Coca-Cola and stuff like that.
Right. Well, I think it's a matter of education. I used to work at a food bank, so I would see sometimes we would be giving away, distributing produce that maybe a family was not familiar with, or a protein that they weren't familiar with. So it's not that they didn't like it, they just didn't know what to do with it. So food banks are starting, a lot of the food banks have nutrition education staff on board, and when they're distributing food, they'll include recipe cards for the different products that they're distributing to educate the folks on the product that they're getting and how to prepare it in a healthy and economical way. So we do see that, absolutely, but I think that could be true for anybody. I think it's a matter of education, and once you understand the calorie count and how much you should be having, and you know how to prepare different fruits and vegetables and how to make it, meal planning and all of that stuff, you know, will help not just people in need but everybody.
Well, apparently one of the most popular recipes this Thanksgiving for turkey is turkey tikka masala, an Indian version. I'm pretty familiar with chicken tikka masala from going to
it's a matter of education and just creativity. I know through our nutritionists that work at food banks, they'll start nutrition education programs with kids at after-school programs, and they'll teach them about healthy fruits and vegetables, really getting the kids, getting their taste eyes and taste buds open to new things. And then, as well, as I mentioned, I know that sometimes we are dependent on donations, so sometimes we get a donation of product that may not be very common use. And so food banks, like I said, will try to either do cooking demos at a distribution, and or, like I mentioned, give out recipes that they can use to try out the product that they're getting.
Well, you mentioned this earlier, Zwani Viriel, who's, the Director of Communication for Feeding America, the nation's largest hunger relief organization. You mentioned the fires out here in California last week, and, of course, the death count continues up in Northern California, and the hurricanes. And you wrote about Puerto Rico in the aftermath of the hurricanes as well, which I want to talk to you about in a bit. But does that mean that at this Thanksgiving there's been a spike in the need to respond to families that have been displaced due to these disasters like fires and hurricanes?
Absolutely. So, you know, we mentioned that about 41 million Americans are struggling with hunger. They're food insecure. But then take into account those families that are victims of natural disasters. So they may not necessarily have been in the position of food insecurity, but now because of the disaster, they have lost everything. I know that in California, our food banks there are working with the shelters and the camp cities and providing food, partnering with the Red Cross and the first responders to provide food to the those families that are displaced. And then also in Florida and the Carolinas, the families that were displaced through the hurricanes. And the wonderful thing, if there is a silver lining when it comes to disaster response, is that our food banks are already in the communities, and so they have those partners in place and partnerships in place and processes. And at the national level, when we know, for example, when a hurricane is going to hit an area, we will stage product not on, you know, where it's going to hit, but near the area, so that we could be easily transported to once it's safe to do so and start distributing food on the ground. So through the network, we're staging food as disasters are impending. We're responding to them once they're on the ground, and our food banks are doing the work day in and day out. And as you mentioned, like Thanksgiving, it's such an important time, and our food banks are scrambled, and they did everything they can to make sure that they get as much food out there to families in need, either that were victims of the disaster or they're just dealing with the daily disaster of food insecurity. They're putting together food boxes that have all the trimmings, you know, the stuffing and the cranberries and the potatoes and stuff like that. And they're sourcing and getting turkeys donated so that they can distribute those out as well.
So let's talk a little bit about, since we're on the subject of natural disasters and or unnatural disasters in the case of the fires here in California, it looks as though they may have been caused by utility lines, etc. But Hurricane Maria, of course, was a huge, actually there was a 1-2 punch that hit Puerto Rico. You went down
with
there.
Irma. After, yeah. Right, I think it was Irma. Was it Irma? And
yeah.
Then Maria?
Then
yeah.
Maria, right. So tell us about what you saw when you got there in the aftermath and how the food banks responded.
Well, it was what I saw when I was there was heartwarming, because I think one of the most important things about food banks and the work that we do is to understand that it's, what we're trying to do is provide food to people in need. And food is a basic human need. Everybody, no matter how old you are, what your background is, what your religion is, we all need those meals to survive on a daily basis. And so more so on the, in times of disaster, we respond, and food banks send staff that they can to impacted areas to help the local food bank out. I know, for example, in Puerto Rico, there was staff that went from Chicago down to the food bank to help, and Texas sent a couple of staff members as well just to help out, because, you know, we know that the food bank that was affected, the one in Puerto Rico, I mean, the families, the staff themselves were dealing with their own struggles as well. It took a long time for the food bank to get the power back on. They were operating on generators. The volunteers were operating just on daylight. They had the warehouse doors open and would just operate in the dark, basically. But they were there. They had volunteers there from the first day that they could, sorting food, getting food boxes, and getting it out. And that network of agencies that the food bank has really mobilized and made sure that they got out to the communities, and even to make sure that everybody had got some food. They would walk, like, line by line, street by street, door to door, knock, and just make sure everybody was okay. And if they needed food, they would give them a food box. So it was a struggle, because we know that the staff there themselves were dealing with issues, and they didn't have electricity in their homes. But everybody came together, because we know it's for the greater good, and what we can do to help other people with food is what we're going to do.
Well, it sounds like what you are doing is quite a contrast to what we saw the President of the United States, Donald Trump, do when he went down there tossing paper towels. Spoken to a number of Puerto Ricans about that, and they weren't particularly happy about that at all.
Right. Probably not the best visual, probably not the best use, but, you know, the food banks were there. The food bank was there. The agencies were there. I saw the work that they were doing, and they worked with FEMA to get product in and get it distributed. And it was hard to get into some of the areas that were highly impacted, because the roads were closed. There was no getting through. But, you know, people are resilient, and they come together and they work together, and we got food out to every county or every municipality there on the island.
So, Zwani Virgil again, the Director of Communications for Feeding America, the nation's largest hunger relief organization. In terms of people being fed today by food banks and volunteers across the country on this Thanksgiving, are there any breakdown of who among our 41 million hungry Americans are? I mean, for example, are there veterans involved in that number?
Yeah, we know that, so there's about 12 million are children. We know that about more than half of the households that we serve have at least one adult that is employed. So they're working. They're just working one or two jobs and underemployed, maybe not making enough to make ends meet. About one-fifth or 20% of the people that receive assistance from the food banks in our network have a member that is either serving or has served in the military. So that's 20% of the people that we serve. And we also know that there's about 7 or 8 million seniors that are food insecure as well. And so we have programs targeted to to help different populations. So for children, we partner with after-school programs. We partner with schools and establish school pantry programs to distribute food out. For the military members, we partner with USO. We partner with the VA and do a mobile pantry program at VAs. And so we reach out to different communities and different populations to serve them and to do as much as we can to help them not just connect to the food bank and our agencies and have access to that network, but then also in any other way that we can help them get back on their feet.
Well, there was a recent statistic that I found extraordinary that says that 45% of U.S. households are headed by women who are the primary breadwinners. So,
and
does
we
that
do
gel
know
with
that,
what does that gel with what you've experienced?
Well, we know that women head of households with children are 2.5 times more likely to struggle. So, I mean, we do see that through our network, through our food banks, and we do know that they're 2.5 times more likely to struggle if it's a women-led head of household with children. So, you know, the more that we can do to reach out to them, to help them connect with other resources, obviously the better that they will be to get back on their feet as quickly as possible.
Well, that's, you know, women holding up more than half the world, isn't it?
I mean. Yeah. Well, yeah, it is true. But, you know, for us and our mission and what we're trying to do, we want to connect with them and we want to connect them with resources. A lot of our food banks do SNAP outreach and outreach for other federal assistance programs such as WIC and Medicaid and other programs. And the food banks, they're in the communities they serve, so they'll also do outreach and help provide additional information for any other resources. So that if there's a local utility company outreach program, you know, they can help connect them with that. They really, the food banks and the people that work at the food banks and volunteer at the food banks really are trying to do everything they can to make sure that families get what they need. And I think a lot of it is, it goes back to what I said earlier, is that we all need food to survive. We all need that fuel to get us up out of bed and to get kids concentrating in school and not thinking about hunger, to get that job, to go to that interview and to work and to make that earn that living. Mm. So I think that's just universal.
Sure. Well, just in the last minute, there's a movie out now about Fred Rogers and his famous TV show for children, The Good Neighbor. And Fred Rogers was such a compassionate and decent man that he never ate on the program because he was aware that a lot of the kids that were watching him were hungry. I wish more of us understood what it's like to be hungry. And just in closing, listening to what you're telling us, it just seems unconscionable that the federal government would even consider cutting back on food stamps. But they do. They keep hammering away at it. So,
well, I mean, we do advocate for a strong farm bill, and that's what they're legislating now. And we appreciate the help of the community to call their elected officials and tell them to support a strong farm bill. But you can find information on our website at feedingamerica.org, and on there how to take action. Advocating is one of those things that you can help with. And just make sure that that they don't cut food stamps, that they don't cut these federal nutrition programs, and because honestly, if any cuts to that will put an undue burden on the charitable food sector, and we can't make up the slack. So we do need the help of advocates to call their elected officials on that.
Well, Zuani Villarreal, I thank you so much for joining us here on this Thanksgiving and for the work that you do and for pointing out to us. I don't mean to depress our listeners on this happy holiday, but we should be aware what's happening to 41 million of our fellow citizens.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, Ian, and thank you for that. It's we should be aware and we can do something about it. And I think there's many different ways that people can get involved and just appreciate the opportunity to talk about that and hopefully inspire some folks to give back and to volunteer and to advocate for those who are hungry.
I thank you again, and I've been speaking with Zoani Villarreal, who is the Director of Communications for Feeding America, the nation's largest hunger relief organization. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back on this Thanksgiving. We'll explore the notion of what we can be thankful for. Like giving food to the hungry again, hope to the needy again, life to a baby, giving care for free, cause there is freedom around us. We have everything we need, and I will care for you, cause you care for me, and we all have opinions. Some of them get through, but there's better. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Schwartz, who's the editor of the daily web publication, the SchwartzReport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future, an area of research he's been working on since the mid-1960s. And previously, he was the senior Samueli Fellow in Brain, Mind, and Healing at the Samueli Institute. And his latest nonfiction book is The Eight Laws of Change. And Eli's novels are Awakening, a novel of aliens and consciousness, and the latest is The Vision, a novel of time and consciousness. Welcome to Background Briefing on this Thanksgiving, Stephen Schwartz.
Good Thanksgiving to you, Ian.
Well, thank you. And I guess the trite question to ask is, what do we have to be thankful for? So many people that I know are deeply anxious about the direction this country is going under the leadership of a man who is so manifestly unqualified and is such a horrible human being. There's just nothing good that comes from him, from his mouth, from his acts. He is ruining this country and endangering the world. So apart from that,
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play?
Right, right. So here I am thrashing about hoping for, since you tend to have a fairly optimistic view in spite of the fact that you are a scholar of trends and future trends, and quite often those trends are alarming, you nevertheless seem to have a fairly hopeful vision. So I'm appealing to you here to be positive.
Well, I agree with your assessment of Donald Trump. It can hardly bear to look at him. And what he's doing to American democracy is just... But you see, it's also what he's doing is what a percentage of the country wants to have done. And so I think we have to face that. But the good news, since we're going to focus on optimistic things on Thanksgiving, is that what I think the last election, which we just had, is telling us is that a significant percentage of the population has awakened to citizen responsibility. I think you can see that in the voter turnout, particularly women, young people, people of color. More good news is a number of the people that have been elected are scientists. So instead of this kind of willful ignorance that we see from the Republican Party, we're going to have in the House a number of new people who have a science background and who take climate change and things like that very seriously. I take that as good news. I also think that it's very good news that there are so many women involved, because if you look across the world and across history, when a significant percentage of the leadership population are women, you have quite different social policies, because women are responsible for historically for taking care of children, and they have a different set of priorities than men do. So I'm very pleased to see that there are so many women that are involved, because I think we're going to see coming out of the House not only many investigations, another piece of good news, we're going to have an accounting, but also we're going to have people who really place social well-being first. I mean, my argument is the central problem that we're facing as a country is that we have only one social priority, and that's profit. And I believe, and I suspect you believe as well, that the function of the state really ought to be to foster well-being from the individual to the family, the community, the nation, and the planet itself. So I see all of that as good news. I also see the rise across the world of non-carbon energy, despite the fact that the Trump administration is taking the completely antipodal position. But for the rest of the world, I see a growing awareness that we must make the transition out of carbon energy. And you can see all across the world, in the developed nations particularly, new programs, new policies, new technologies. We won't be the leaders, but there will be changes that are coming, and I think those are also positive. I think we are also seeing, we have been experiencing the collapse of antibiotic medicine, the growth of superbugs and all of that, but we're now also seeing in medicine whole new approaches to medical research. And I think some really positive things are going to come out of that. And I think finally we're beginning to have a recognition. It's like a little sprout in the spring, just a little tiny sprout with a few leaves. We're beginning to recognize that there are some fundamental flaws that the founders simply did not anticipate. We need to get rid of the Electoral College. And we need to change the way the Senate is structured, because what's going to happen is about 12% of the population who live in states that have very, very low populations are developing a much greater level of power relative to high population states that in the Senate have the same representation. So I think I'm beginning to see that. I mean, I look at trends, so I'm looking at things which are just beginning, as well as things that are fully underway. And I think we are beginning to really recognize that climate change is going to fundamentally change the nature of human civilization and the planet itself.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's the editor of the daily web publication, the SchwartzReport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future, an area of research he's been working on since the mid-1960s. And previously, he was a senior Samueli Fellow in Brain, Mind, and Healing at the Samueli Institute. So you mentioned that we were hopefully going away from the domination of our government and our lives being predicated on profit. That, of course, is an extension of our money-driven political system, which is entirely dictated by, certainly since Citizens United's Supreme Court decision, has created a situation in which our politicians, our representatives, have become telemarketers. They spend their days dialing for dollars. It is a completely money-driven system, but on the optimistic side, to add to your list there of what we have to be optimistic about, I think this last election, with people like Beto O'Rourke running in Texas, indicated that politicians, if they've got a good message and have public support, can get small donations which can be competitive. In Beto's case, he actually raised more money than Ted Cruz.
Yes, I think that's all part of this citizens' awakening to the responsibility that they have to maintain democracy. I mean, the thing about democracies are they only work when the citizens work to make them happen. It doesn't come from the top down. It comes from the bottom up. And this last election, I think what we have been seeing is a reawakening to this responsibility that citizenship conveys, and people taking it seriously. The number of young people that voted, the increasing role of women, the role of people of color. We are facing an extraordinarily difficult time. The next 20, 30 years is going to be really, really tough. And the fact that people are beginning to take seriously what's happening, I think, is important. The other thing I really should have mentioned also is what I call the thriving community movement. There is a whole movement going on across the country of people who are not normally involved in political process, but who are so put off by what's happening at the federal level, the complete abdication of the Republican Party for its responsibility of governance, the disaster of Donald Trump and Michael Pence, that people at the local level, you know, the community level, are beginning to awaken to the idea that if it's not happening at the top, then it's got to happen at the bottom. And you're seeing, and I've been following this closely, you're seeing communities all over the country, even communities in red states, blue states, where at the community level there is a movement, first, for much greater citizen involvement, and second of all, for the creation of policies that will prepare us for the future. I mean, if the federal government and the state government won't do anything about climate change, then localities are beginning to do this, because the thing about mayors is they actually have to govern. You know, when the sewage system backs up or the electricity fails, you can't bloviate your way through that. You really have to govern, and you have to lead. And so we're seeing at the mayoral level, at the city council level, at the county commissioner level, we're beginning to see an awakening that if it's not being done from the top, then it's got to be done at the bottom. And I think that's actually quite promising.
And let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Stephen Schwartz on this Thanksgiving.
Well, they called me once, and they called me twice. Third time they called me was cold as ice. They say, get to the table on time. Better make up your mind if you want to get to the table on time. Better get to the table, get to the table on time. Turkey for me, turkey for you. Let's eat the turkey in my big brown shoe. Love to eat the turkey at the table. I once saw a movie with Betty Grable. Eat that turkey all night long. 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong. Turkey lurkey do and turkey lurkey dap. I eat.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with Stephen Schwartz, the editor of the daily web publication, the theschwartzreport.net, and the author of The 8 Laws of Change. And you mentioned the challenges in terms of demographics, more people moving into the cities, into the blue states, and diluting the red states. But nevertheless, in spite of that, the red states are gaining more political power in the Senate because of the Electoral College, and by the year 2040, there'll be 70 senators from red states and 30 senators from blue states. And we learned from the last election that Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes in the key blue states, but they didn't count. So that's a real challenge going forward, because if the Republicans can control the Senate into the future, they will control the courts. And I think we've reached a point, perhaps even a point of no return, in terms of Trump being able to add extremely reactionary judges to the Supreme Court and to the federal bench.
Yes, I agree with that. I think Mitch McConnell, history will record him as a truly evil person, because what he's trying to do and what the Republican Party is trying to do is to cement into place judges who will interpret the law in a way that is favorable to profiteers, grifters, and grafters. I mean, we have a lot of problems. There's no getting around it. America is in, from my perspective, historically, as a historian of the early American Republic, I mean, I look at what's happening and I think about what Benjamin Franklin actually intended, what Jefferson intended, what Madison, Monroe intended, and you see the great chasm from what was originally intended to where we are. So I think you have to be honest and say we are going through a very, very bleak period. The fact that we're not making the preparations we should be making for climate change, I think, are particularly extraordinary, because you're beginning to see now in the media, I've been talking about climate change since 1991. I used to go around and give talks about climate change at conferences, and people would just dismiss me as a kind of nut. But now, of course, it's all exactly as predicted is coming true, because I was speaking on the basis of science and not politics and polemics and all that sort of thing. We are in a really very tough place, but we are beginning to see some, since we're talking about Thanksgiving, we'll put a positive slant on it and say that we are beginning to see at both local levels and in some states, in the blue states, at the state level, we're beginning to see finally a real awareness. I mean, you can see it, you live in California, and you can see in what's going on, the discussions that are taking place about these dreadful fires, a recognition that climate change is going to wreak enormous devastation unless preparations are made to prepare for it. You know, nature bats last. I mean, you can bloviate and obfuscate and provide disinformation and just general nonsense as much as you like. Sea rise doesn't care. The collapse of the ocean ecology doesn't care. The increase in storms and cataclysmic events which move populations none of those meta processes of the earth care about what you're saying politically. And I think people are finally beginning to wake up to this, particularly in the states where it's happening. I can see it in North Carolina, where you're not even allowed, by according to the state legislature, to talk about climate change, but you talk to somebody who's down not only in North but South Carolina after Florence, and you can see people who really get what's going on. People are still in Houston, New Orleans, in the American Virgins, Puerto Rico. They are beginning to really confront what climate change is going to do. And as grim as that may be at the sort of present day, I think it is engendering in the future an awakening awareness that we have got to take positive steps. And if it won't happen at one level, then it must happen at another level of government. So I think that is positive good news.
Well, in terms of the fires here in California, of course, the president was out here and visiting recently in California, and he suggested that we just need to rake the leaves, which was just so absurd. The firemen, everybody just groaned and couldn't believe the stupidity of this man. And he does represent a growth of or almost a liberation of anti-intellectualism. I think it began under Sarah Palin when she gained national prominence by John McCain selecting her. Suddenly you had this incredible manifestation of stupidity on the world stage, even with a slim chance of becoming vice president and therefore president. That didn't happen, but this guy did happen. And he said on the stump, I love the poorly educated. And if you listen to him, he just simply doesn't make any sense. It's deeply embarrassing. I don't know whether you watched the recent ceremony at the White House where he gave out the highest civilian honors to the wife of a donor, Sheldon Adelson's wife. And the man is just shockingly stupid and ill-informed. So I want to get from you a sense of what is the reason for this kind of obdurate constituency of anti-intellectualism that seems to be maintaining itself in the bubble that Fox News creates for it. And I just don't understand, or I don't really know what the percentages are. Are we a country that has a majority of sane and sensible people, or are we a country that has a majority of ill-educated, angry, confused, and ignorant people?
Well, the first thing I think that you have to recognize is that Trump is a symptom, not the disease. He's like having a pustule if you had the plague. So he is as vile as you say, but he is a symptom. And he is a symptom of what I think are the four major trends which are shaping the future right now that nobody talks about, or very little it's talked about. I won't say nobody, but very little is talked about. You certainly aren't going to hear it on the evening news. So the four trends are: being born white will no longer confer privilege. Second trend, being born male will no longer bestow dominance. Third trend, Western, European, and North Atlantic culture values will no longer be the sole way the world is organized. Fourth trend, the rise of neo-feudalism and the conveyance of real power from the nation state to the corporate state, and the rise of a tiny nobility of wealth, a few dozen people, a larger aristocracy of wealth as opposed to blood in the earlier feudal period, and then a small professional class who act as the managers for the uber rich, and a large wage earner peasantry, serfdom. And the fear that that is producing, what's going on, what's driving all of this, in my opinion, and as you know, I have a whole other life in neuroscience and consciousness research. What's driving this, I think, is first of all the precognitive awareness that something really dreadful is coming in terms of climate change. People just have this inchoate. It's not a cognitive awareness. It's just this kind of existential dread. That's one part of it. The other part is that for a certain percentage of white people, and particularly white men, the loss of their perceived status and authority is really causing them to panic. And that's part of what's driving the Trumpers. You know, the interesting thing, again, which you just don't hear anybody talk about, but that's very stands out a great deal for me, is Mussolini had the black shirts, Hitler had the brown shirts, Trump's got the red hatters. This idea of creating a distinctive kind of clothing, it's a kind of totem that lets people know where you are and that you belong to this group. So this is a fear-centered group. They're fearing loss of power, loss of status, loss of the way things are or were as they perceived it. And in their paranoia, in their fear, in their anger, Trump is their manifestation. He is their creature. And he articulates for them what they want to believe. It's not the truth, but it's what they want to believe. And that's why he can lie day after day. I mean, it's up to over 6,000 lies. I mean, he doesn't seem to be capable of making an honest statement about anything. And everything is self-referential. I mean, no matter what he's doing, it's always self-referential. And all of that is because this is a group of population of about 40% of the country, apparently, who are completely self-referential, who are terrified about the changes that are coming, who feel their loss of status, their loss of familiarity, their sense of powerlessness, and Trump is their manifestation. So how do you deal with that? Well, I wrote the 8 Laws of Change because I was concerned about this exact issue. And the answer to the question of how do you deal with the Trumpers is that you use what I call the quotidian choice. It's very simple. And Thanksgiving is a good day to talk about it. Every day you make hundreds of decisions. You buy gasoline, you buy toilet paper, you buy toothpaste, you buy cat food, whatever. You make hundreds of little choices. Those are votes. You're choosing what you want to support. So the question you must ask yourself every day is, I need to be aware when I'm making a choice that I'm actually making a decision that is a vote. That's one. Two, that of the options that are available to me, I will consistently choose the one that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being. And that I will tell 10 of my friends that I am doing this as a discipline and invite them to join me and ask 10 of their friends. And believe it or not, I know it sounds implausible and impossible and all, I've heard all those things, but the truth of the matter is, and I can give you historical examples, is that if all the people who are listening to your show, which are many thousands of people, if everybody who is listening to this show on Thanksgiving Day would make the commitment that from this day forward, every choice I make will be, to the best of my ability, the one that confirms compassion, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being, the world will change. I mean, you can look at, for instance, the Me Too movement. Look at that. That didn't arise from the top. It arose from the bottom. You can look at the change in why people don't smoke that much anymore. There was no big announcement. No law was passed. It was made at the local level. You can see the change in the acceptance of the LGBTQ communities, that it's not something that's coming from the top down, it's going from the bottom up. And so if enough of us, and we even know how many we need 10% of the population to be seriously committed to always choosing that which is compassionate and life-affirming. And if we will do that and go forward from Thanksgiving 2018, within a year, let's say 2 years, by 2020 in the next presidential election, we will have a different country because people will make different choices. This is a democracy is about the collective intention of a group of people. It's not something that starts from the top down. It starts from the bottom up. And if we're going to do this, we have to, on this Thanksgiving Day, commit ourselves to walking the talk that speaks to us, because that's what the other people are doing.
Well, Stephen Schwartz, I thank you very much for joining us on this Thanksgiving.
My pleasure, and you have a great Thanksgiving.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's the editor of the daily web publication, the SchwartzReport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future, an area of research he's been working on since the mid-1960s. Previously, he was a senior Samueli Fellow in Brain, Mind, and Healing at the Samueli Institute. And his latest nonfiction book is The 8 Laws of Change. And his latest fiction books are Awakening, a novel of aliens and consciousness, and The Vision, a novel of time and consciousness. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loves.